Welcome to the 13th weekly To Know Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. In the last couple of weeks, the sense of crisis has only grown. The alleged murder of George Floyd has resulted in protests around the world, and there are serious questions about if the progress we'd hoped we'd made in terms of racial diversity is real. Businesses are struggling to know what to do and stay, and many are squirming when forced to confront their own records.
Hello.
If it were possible, confusion around...
I'm fine. I'm on the Teneo call. I'm just listening. That's okay. No, it's okay.
If it were possible, COVID-19 is getting worse. Epidemiologists warn about it starting to rampage through South America and the developing world. Many fear a second spike in the US and Europe. But others, including an Oxford professor, declare the lockdown is futile and arbitrary, saying it should end right now because of the economic damage. In this country, the picture is particularly confused, to put it mildly. There are daily announcements about easing the lockdown, and yet on Monday, a draconian plan to quarantine all people who come into the country for 2 weeks was put into force. Businesses pointed out it was unworkable. Worse, some claimed it had only been implemented because it was popular in focus groups. And there's more. Zoos opening, but not schools. A prediction of 10 million people on NHS waiting lists by the end of this year. Boris Johnson planning a major speech in July to discuss boosting the economy. So much to discuss, and fortunately, we've got another brilliant panel. Ursula Burns is a Teneo senior advisor, is chair of Vion, and a former CEO of Xerox. She's going to discuss how leaders in business are reacting to pressure for more racial diversity and the ongoing COVID crisis. Stephanie Flanders is the former economics editor of the BBC, and after a stint at JP Morgan, is now head of Bloomberg Economics. James Graham is one of the country's leading writers for theatre, television and film. His credits include Quiz, The Story of the Coughing Major, This House, Brexit, The Uncivil War and Ink. He'll be talking about the threat to theatre and bringing his writer's view of the current politics. And finally, Amber Rudd, a regular on these calls, is a Teneo senior advisor and former Home Secretary. Hopefully she can explain the apparent contradictions in the government position. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute, a few of you haven't been, throughout this call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. Ursula, you need to be at a board meeting at 12, so let's start with you. Businesses are struggling to deal with the double impact of COVID and concerns and failures on racial diversity. Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the impact of COVID on business has been well articulated and fairly well understood broadly. And we just got shocked in the United States, but I think around the world, primarily in the United States, with a new problem, and that is the murder of George Floyd. It's not alleged. He was actually murdered, and the people are brought up on charges of it by a police person and his three compatriots. And that alone would have been disruptive, but probably would have, like many of the other incidents, the previous incidents, would have been a spike of anger and unsettledness, and then have passed, unfortunately. But I think that what's happened in the United States, I hope is happening around the world, is the compounding effect of a large amount of disruption. One is COVID, and in the United States in particular, I think in the UK as well, COVID has hit Black and brown people, poor people, women, especially hard. And these people have been called what we call essential workers, even though in society they're not treated as essential people. And so the feelings of inequality and inequity are being raised and being heightened. At the same time that that happens, we have a African-American man, a Black man who was killed, taped from the beginning to the end by a police person. And that compounded with COVID brought emotions high. And then the third issue was that we have a very uncaring and unfeeling administration where the president of the United States, instead of trying to dampen down the flames, has actually been stoking them and making them making the discourse significantly more vitriolic. And so coming together, first young people started to take their message, their anger to the streets, then older people, first Black, and now every racial mix in America is out in the streets. Businesses are now starting to speak up. So it's the perfect storm for America, but it's also the perfect storm for change right about now in America. There's a large amount of discourse about policing, about gender and racial equality, about socioeconomic reform, and it's not dying down anywhere near as quickly as the people who are in comfortable positions would like it to be. So I think it's actually a very important time. It's a very, very important time for businesses, because this is a point where, I don't know if you guys are watching, but people are watching in America to see what businesses are saying about what. Who's gonna lead the way? So Twitter has come out and said, look, we're gonna actually be more controlling about what is posted, not only of the president, but of people broadly, because we cannot be a contributor to the misnews, to the racial inequality, et cetera. Starbucks has come out. A lot of businesses are coming. Cisco has come out. A lot of businesses have come out and said, fundamentally, we have to contribute to the solutions, not the problems. And we're starting to now see businesses that are being affected negatively by not having a voice, by being silent, which before would have been an acceptable thing to do. Just kind of keep your head low and duck under the noise. But now it's not, it's becoming less and less acceptable to do that. So I think it's actually a very, very interesting and exciting time for change in America. And I'm hoping the rest of the world as well.
So it's interesting you say that about the business coming out and the expectation on them. I think a lot of businesses are struggling because they don't know if they're going to say the right thing. And also the truth is, a lot of businesses, when you shine a spotlight on them, don't have a brilliant record on this.
I think both are true. Let's start with the brilliant record. When you say a lot of businesses, I don't think that there is a business that has a record that's anywhere near acceptable on this, right? And I do agree. I was on a call with a European leader of a sporting goods multinational, and it was just an amazing call, very, very good call. He called to say, I don't know what I don't know. I do know that I don't know things. I need some help. And the reason why they're calling me is because I seem to look like one of those Black and brown people, and maybe I may have some information on this. It's really interesting that you have to kind of reach that far out of your company, right? But I think that that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is that people don't see any affinity. They see no need. They think they can avoid fundamental inequality, long-standing inequality in their business places, and they only put their heads up when they are called to the task. And I think that businesses, like this sporting goods person, says, wait a minute, way before I get called to task, I gotta get smart on this. I know I'm not doing enough. I know that this is partly my problem as well. This is not just the Black and brown people who have to take care of themselves. They are consumers of my product. My people live and work in the communities that my business are in. A good and sound and trusting economy in the capitalism is what we need for our businesses to grow. They're starting to realize more and more that they have skin in the game here. It's not an avoidable thing.
So I was reading something yesterday which went back over a century about when there had been racial protests in America. And it basically pointed out that there were government reports each time. And each time they essentially said the same thing about what needed to happen. And it was kind of making the point of like, so what's different now? Are we all going to agree that something needs to be done and then nothing does happen? Do you fear that?
Yeah, maybe. Do I fear it? Yes. That's one of the reasons why I march. That's one of the reasons why I agitate like hell. I think we have a chance now of, like I said, things coming together. We have Me Too, we have Black Lives Matters, we have coronavirus, we have at least one, maybe two, just totally inept leaders in government kind of trying to lead us through all of this discourse. And we have businesses and people, young people, old people, Black, white, men, women saying, maybe enough is enough now. You know, we've been cooped up for all this time, and the vast majority of us are living like normal human beings, crowded in spaces that are small, without children, you know, not a lot of grace. And we don't seem to be getting a lot of relief or help or understanding from the government or clarity from the government. And now I think that everything is so unsettled that this is an opportunity to catapult that level of discourse into a better discussion about, it's not gonna happen tomorrow. It's not gonna happen tomorrow, meaning it's gonna take a while for this discussion to happen, but I think that it's possible that we can actually go to another level. I'm hoping that that's the case. And one more thing, Craig, on the studies, I just had another one. We went through, there's a whole bunch of CEOs who are meeting to discuss this. Another study, 2015, on policing in America. Unbelievable, blue ribbon, blue panel study done under President Obama. There was probably one done under every president except for our current president, who doesn't particularly seem to care. But every president has done one. Some presidents have done two, three. And you're right. The great news about these studies is that you could just copy the previous study. You don't have to do, you don't have to, you know, get the money and just kind of change the names. The bad news about the bad news about the study is that we enact some of it. We have forces against it, establishment forces against it. And it the how do I say, the stick-to-itiveness of not only the government, but the businesses and the people who are pushing for change, it's just not long enough. This is going to be a long discussion, and it's just not long enough yet.
We could spend the whole of this hour talking about this and barely scratch the surface. I'm going to ask you one more question. Let's get specific. Lots of well-meaning, right-thinking liberal business leaders say they want to do something, and then they're confronted by the reality. Give me specifics. What should business leaders be doing? Should they be having quotas? What?
And I've gone public on my quota statement, which has caused me to get death threats from conservative people. I think that I'd look close to home. Start close to home, right? Start in your boardroom. Start on your management team. Tell me who's there. Tell me what they look like. Tell me what their experience base is. And I can almost assure you, 499 of the 500 biggest businesses in the UK, 499 of the 500 biggest businesses in the US have an appalling record in this area. Very non-diverse boards, very non-diverse management teams. That's the first place. The first place that you can actually get closer to reality of the world, where more than 50% of the population are not white men. 70% of the population is not white men. But you look at the business structures that we have around the world, it is literally white men. So I say, look close to home and start to actually practice what you think goodness looks like in your own business. Second, expand a little bit bigger. You actually have to source people, hire better, right? Start to hire more diverse, become affirmative in your actions, not affirmative action, but become affirmative in your actions. If you leave it to the current status of how you hire and promote, we know exactly what the outcome is. The outcome is a set of organizations filled with mid to top white males who have a certain type of education, who have a certain type of background. So I say the first thing is start close to home and make sure your business structures are the way that they should be. They should be diverse, men, women, black, white, whatever. Your hiring practices and your promotion practices should be able to allow for growth of all the people in the company. You should then go one circle out, make sure the communities that you do business in have your voice and your stamp on them. This is one of the things we're pushing for in America. This thing that policing is not our business, all of your employees go home to communities. You have a point of view. Your business has a point of view. That point of view has to be heard.
Ursula, we're incredibly fortunate that you've joined us today. I know how busy you were, but you think it's really important, and we think it's really important too. So thank you for taking the time. You've got to disappear into your board meeting, but we'd love to have you back, because I think this isn't going away, and I think we need to hear more about it. But thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hope it doesn't go away, by the way, and I hope that we do spend some more time talking about it. Thank you very much, everyone on the call.
Thanks, Ursula. Okay, we're going to move now to Stephanie, on to COVID. Tough act to follow, Stephanie, but we'll hand it to you. Listen, we worked together when you were economics editor of the BBC. You've gone to JP Morgan, now you're at Bloomberg Economics. I think a lot of people are now starting to feel that economics is becoming almost more important than the health thing. We've seen 3 months of health. Where are we on this globally in the UK?
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Craig. I mean, actually, what is quite useful about being the current setup at Bloomberg is that I've got economists and reporters. So we've got about 100 economic reporters around the world. It's a media organization that still actually has money to invest, which is nice to see. And about 30 economists. So what's been great for me is we've been getting the economists to look on the ground at what's happening and have that be informed by reporting. So if you look at, I mean, one thing that is exceptional about this crisis economically, which I think we should remember is a good thing, is that not only you've seen these big numbers in terms of the shrinking of the economy much faster than we've seen before, in certainly outside wartime, potentially a bigger fall in UK GDP on the order of 10 or 11% than any other than some of the other European countries. But at the same time, you've seen this unprecedented increase in fiscal support and government support. So when you do, when I get my economists to look at what the hole in the income is that's been left by the income gap that's been left by everyone being forced to go home, more in most countries and in the UK, the fiscal support has matched that income gap. So you've got a situation where the economy has plunged, but actually when you look across sort of total incomes across the country, it's not gone down. In the case of the US, there's actually going to be a rise in aggregate income in the second quarter because of the amount of money that's gone flowing to households, including low-income households, by the way, even as you see the economy itself fall off a cliff. So that is something that's different about this recession, and I think could help us see some kind of what you might call V-shaped recovery. I know it became a, we decided that there was not going to be a V-shaped recovery, but actually when you look across Europe, France, Germany, they are getting a really rapid comeback in production once they lift the lockdown. So in France, I think, they gained about 20% of GDP in terms of their production levels in 2 weeks just from lifting the lockdown. So we know it's there. What we'll expect, what we probably will see was, is that V, at the end of that V shape, it'll level off something like 10% below where it was, if you, as long as you don't have a vaccine, as long as you don't have social distancing, making some economic activities unprofitable or impossible. But the UK raises an interesting question. I don't think it's so much about a trade-off between the economy and health, because if you have a second wave, I think economists agree that that's devastating for the economy as well. But you do have all the evidence in the continental Europe shows the importance of the public having confidence. You know, you can send the factories back to work, you can get production back to where you were, but consumption doesn't come back unless people feel confident in the test and tracing things, and there's transparency about where the government is going. And I'm sure Amber will talk about this, but I think that's the unanswered question in the UK. We've had, we may in the end have a twice as long lockdown period in weeks than say Germany. We came into it late by common agreement. As we're coming out of it, there does seem to be a lack of, certainly a lack of clarity, but there's also, if you look at the polls, you've still got a majority of people not even thinking we should lift now. So I think that we don't know whether that V-shape is going to be there for us, at least on the consumption side, because we haven't got a government yet that's shown that it's on top of the situation in the absence of a vaccine. So I think that's what, you know, I worry about most right now from a UK perspective. Obviously, there's longer term questions around the scarring on the economy, which I don't think we'll be able to avoid. We might see a hint of that when the government starts to remove the furlough or require employers to start paying workers. We'll discover whether those jobs are still viable that have been paid by the Treasury all this time. When we look globally, we are looking at high frequency data all the time to see the shape of the recovery. I think the US, the question mark is not so much about the ability to come back, but whether that fiscal support will be maintained when you get to pass the election and when potentially the Republicans are not dealing with a Democrat president, if we get a Democrat president. So that's one thing we're looking at. Overall, I think lots of questions that businesses are asking about the future of global supply chains, what this massive increase in public debt is going to do, and whether it will continue to be absorbed by financial markets. You know, I'm happy to go into that, but I know you value brevity above all, Craig, so I'll leave those things hanging there and we'll come back to them.
I'm sure they will come up in the questions. And just a reminder to people that there is a chat function if they drag their cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, and we can put the questions to you as they come. we're really ranging right across the horizon today. I'm going to come to James next. James, you're really passionate about theatre. You're worried about the impact that it's having and the fact that they're all closed at the moment. I'm going to start by asking you, you know, why should we care? And also, you've written hugely about politics. Are you tempted to write about this too?
I think the why should we care issue is obviously really important. It's obviously the case that theatre and the arts are not more important than any other sector that's been affected by COVID-19. It's just unfortunately the case that theatre and live performing venues will be the most affected because of what is probably self-evident. In order for it to work, we need to gather loads of people together closely in an indoor space, and based on Public Health England's recommendations, that if the 2 meter social distancing recommendation continues, that means we can't, there's no viable economic argument to open theatres across the country probably for the rest of this year. Why should we care? I mean, I know that it has a perception problem, the arts, that it is just for the elites, the metropolitan middle class bubble. But actually, in fact, looking outside of London, you have 1,100 theatres across the country. Often these buildings are sometimes the main employer in their local towns. And in an age actually when social and physical infrastructure over the course of the past couple of decades has often diminished in some of these communities, it's sometimes one of the only places for people to physically gather and see themselves as part of a community. I can speak from experience coming from Ashfield and in the Mansfield area, where across the high street, there, you know, as leisure centres close, and even pubs in England can't even survive, and they've been closing, post offices, youth centres, libraries. So where do people physically go to see themselves as part of a literal community? I think moving forward, if theatres do survive, then they have a civic and social responsibility to be that place, not just the show that goes up at 7:30 every night, but as a building that is open all day round for community engagement. There's 300,000 people who rely on theatres to survive for their employment. The majority of those are freelancers. I know we think of the professions being incredibly glamorous. For a very small amount of certainly the acting profession, it's quite glamorous, but for the majority of people, it's job to job, hand to mouth. And actually, I agree with Stephanie, of course, that the income has not necessarily gone down across most households, but there's a sort of an artistic community who weren't either captured by the job retention scheme or the self-employment scheme, because they bounce between the two, who have no income at all. So the reason why theatres are most vulnerable is because of that. It will be the longest closed. It's you know, it sounds very London 1623, but the playhouses were the first to close in the plague, and the playhouses are the last to open in the plague. It could be 6, 7, 8 months with zero income. So I think also it's also the case, and we've been trying to make this case to government, who I think are probably worried about sector-specific support, and especially a sector like theatre, which maybe has the perception of being elitist, even though actually 1 in 2 people do go and see a play or a musical a year. It's the fact that theatres exist in this wider connected ecosystem. So we're very lucky in this country, unlike, say, the United States, which is very coastal. You have film production on the West Coast and theatre production on the East Coast, and never the two really meet. In the UK, what makes us really strong is that theatre, TV and film all feed into one another. And that there's the skills and the learning there makes us one of the most valuable production bases in the world. That's why the Star Wars movies are made in England. That's why Hollywood productions were coming here for many years, and we were actually over capacity in terms of the amount of people we had available to make these things. I can speak from personal experience. I had a show on ITV that you referenced, Craig, called Quiz, which was about the coughing major scandal. Not hugely political or provocative, but it was. I was pleased to say it was a nice hit over Easter. That came from a play in a theatre, and that's now currently showing in the United States, and it's about to go to, I think, about 40 territories worldwide. The obvious example, of course, is Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I started writing with Phoebe about 10, 15 years ago above a pub. Fleabag started as a one-woman monologue in a very small 50-seat space in Soho, and it's now the former president, Barack Obama's favourite show, and she's bringing Amazon shows over to England to be produced here. Then it's not just an economic thing, it's obviously about global reputation, and in an age when we don't make and export very much anymore, in an age when possibly our political reputation is taking some damage, I think having Americans laugh out loud quite a lot at British humour, it may seem frivolous and incidental, but actually it's one of the biggest and most important public-facing things, I think that we do. We're really good at it. It really matters to people. It's a profitable industry in normal times, but the unique nature of a virus means that we cannot open, I think, possibly for the rest of this year. So if we're going to maintain that healthy ecosystem, then we just unfortunately need some support from the government, but making that case, I get, is difficult. Am I going to write a COVID play? I couldn't think of anything worse at the moment. But I do believe in the social value and the political value of drama. I dragged you kicking and screaming onto the screen, Craig, in my Brexit movie, The Uncivil War, where Rory Kinnear played you in the referendum drama. I believe, possibly sentimentally and pompously, that that drama and storytelling, especially when it's on television, is a sort of public square where, unlike the toxicity of social media or comment threads on a newspaper article, there's a more reasonable, compassionate, empathetic space that drama offers as a public service, whereby you can more reasonably tell different points of view. And in an age, as Ursula was talking about, the vitriolic nature of the discourse now, everybody has different frames through which they see the world, and magically, television dramas and plays are one of the few last remaining frames where everybody enters the space and sees exactly the same thing. And I think that has a huge political and emotional importance as well. So that's why I think we need to save theatre. We're very good at it. It makes a profit, and it has a huge social function too.
James, that was fantastic. I know lots of people will want to ask some questions about it too. We're now going to go completely to another subject. So we really are ranging across the horizon now. We're going to go to Amber to talk about the current political situation. I mean, a lot of people are really genuinely confused this week, aren't they? That, schools aren't opening, we're having quarantine for everybody coming into the country, and yet the government's prevailing message seems to be that the lockdown needs to be eased. It doesn't seem to make sense, does it?
I'm afraid it doesn't seem to make sense. And on many different levels, the messaging is conflicting and is leading to what Stephanie referred to, really, which is a breakdown of trust, which could have a devastating impact on confidence. Every time I listen to government ministers on the radio, on the TV this morning, I basically feel rather sorry for them, because they are sent out without proper information to try and defend a position which is incredibly difficult and which quite often reverses quite soon afterwards. And I think that there's only so much of that that the public can take. It's about the way that this government is run, which is extremely centrally, with Boris's inner committee being the only group that really understands what's going on, and other ministers and indeed some secretaries of state being treated to a certain extent like sacrificial lambs, being sent out to defend the position, to take the hit, and then to come back into the fold and be patted on the back and said thank you. But I just don't think that's sustainable in terms of building the trust that is so important. I mean, there are two areas where MPs and I think the public are generally pretty irritated because there's so much confusion. On the first stage, it's the whole issue of introducing the quarantine on flights coming into the UK now. I haven't heard a single coherent argument for it. And I'm, like most people, I'm open to it. But if ministers keep on saying we're following the science but fail to show us the science, again, it just leads to irritation that they are being driven by what is the likely reason for this, which is that the focus groups like it, they think. So they're saying, look, we may not have got into lockdown early enough, although we won't admit that, but the quarantining shows that we're being tough and we're doing the right thing. So my expectation on that is that it is dropped as early as possible and everyone can breathe a sigh of relief and get on, but not until it's had its 3 weeks. And the second one, which I think is more sort of devastating for the UK, is on schools. You switch on the radio at the moment, there's everybody who you know is a kind of, in a way, independent expert in schools, is longing for the schools to go back. But unfortunately, the way the government has handled it, they have been unable to give confidence about schools reopening, not only ahead of the summer, which had been the pledge for primary schools, but also even for secondary schools in the autumn. And I think that comes back to the confused messaging, which is we need to reopen the economy. It is now more of an economic crisis potentially than a health crisis. And yet we have frightened people to such a degree in terms of staying inside that they won't come out. If you talk to teachers now, they are genuinely concerned that when they go back into the schools, they know they can't do 2 meter or even 1 meter social distancing. And yet the government is still saying, you've got to do the social distancing, or it could, you could catch it, you could spread it, etc. How do we reconcile those? And there's been no attempt to do that at the moment from the centre. And I think that's part of the problem. Of course, the fact is the teaching unions are also up in arms about this and using the opportunity to try and score some points. But the net result is that I think there's a growing awareness that we are leaving a generation out. The whole issue of the growth in inequality, which we heard from Ursula earlier, is going to impact this particular generation who are at school. So I do think the government's got a problem. MPs, and I speak to quite a few of them, are, you know, largely Conservative MPs, naturally supportive of Boris, but they're quietly fuming. And they're fuming because they get a lot of emails and requests from their constituents spelling things out. Am I allowed to do this? Am I allowed to do that? And they're supposed to be the arbiters for that. And while the messaging is confusing, that really complicates things. Finally, if I may, on theatres, just to say how much I agree with James, how important the arts are and the performing theatres, live performances in particular. And in the UK, we do have this strong exceptionalism that we're particularly good at and we're admired internationally. And boy, as we come out of this, we need to be admired internationally. We need that to continue. And it's one area that may not be, I hope, too badly affected by Brexit. On Brexit, there is no appetite at all amongst Conservative MPs to do anything except support Boris and whatever he decides to do, which is likely to, which is, you know, it's going to continue the negotiations, but I think it's a 50-50 chance whether we leave without a trade deal at the end of the year. There's no chance of doing a transition as has been set out. So I think the government at the moment is missing the opportunity to go out and make a big push about theatre and the arts, which would reinforce why the UK should be admired rather than, as we feel slightly, I think, internationally at the moment, pitied because of our response to COVID.
Thank you, Amber. Huge amounts to chew on there. I want to start by, we heard last week that Rishi Sunak, and in fact with briefing, the Treasury was briefing, there was going to be a big fiscal moment in July, a lot of stimulus. Then as the week went on, they started backing away from it. Then we started to hear that Boris Johnson is going to do a big speech on the economy. Starting with you, Stephanie, what can he really do in order to actually make things better? And Amber, do you think that it's actually going to be politically significant? But Stephanie first, what would you like to see in that?
I think there's two interpretations of the sort of back and forth over what will happen in the summer. I think there is a sort of obvious feeling that the Prime Minister might want to talk big about all this stuff and not give too much of the limelight to the Chancellor. But more charitably, and I think with some justice, you could say it is also hard, in a way, July is too soon to be making a sort of fundamental assessment of what you need to do to the economy, because we genuinely don't know. I mean, I mentioned what would happen after when you start to see the change in the furlough. I mean, that is really fundamental. Then you find out, when you start asking workers who have been furloughed and maybe bring some of them back part time, you find out whether those employers actually have viable businesses in this environment and what kind of long term impact we could have on unemployment. So I think if you're the Treasury, it actually does make sense to put off some major decisions until we see what the path of the recovery looks like as we come out of lockdown. We had always assumed that, in keeping with the rest of continental Europe, most of the lockdown will be over by the end of the second quarter, so the end of June. It looks like the UK alone among European countries you're going to have quite significant impacts of lockdown going through into the third quarter, which does make it harder for the Treasury to say, okay, we're now out of lockdown, what's happening now? So that's one thing. I think what they need to be focused on is, I think, particularly the younger people. So we have an unusually large percentage of people, younger people, employed in these very socially undistanced jobs and jobs that have been highly vulnerable to this, you know, hospitality, everything else, but to these to the lockdown. So I think anything that is focused on them, on improving training, which, as Amber knows, we need to do anyway, finding ways to reskill, to help reskill people or get them back into training. I think that would be, if I were going to pick one thing, along with going younger and some of the challenges around education, using school through the summer to help kids, as Amber has highlighted how important that is. I'd probably focus on that. And frankly, his talk about the Prime Minister's talk about building hospitals it strikes me as sort of classic Boris Johnson wanting to put his name on something, but not really of the moment. It's investing in people, it's social infrastructure that we should be trying to preserve now, not build lots of hospitals, which won't, by the way, get built in the next year or two.
Amber, you and I were talking about the possibility of more sin taxes and obesity being a focus. What else do you think we can see in this July speech, if anything at all?
Yes, I still think there's going to be a fair amount of greening of the infrastructure proposals, because it's a kind of legitimate way of saying we're going to spend all this money, but we're going to do it in order to deliver on our climate change promises, etc. It's the opposite to a sin tax, really. It's about virtue, doing something that is virtuous. So I think we'll see some of that. I understand that the energy paper has now been put off till September. So I think that sort of plays into a little bit what Stephanie was saying about the reflections that I think that are going on at the moment, is whether July is too early to make a big speech setting out the spending, when in fact they need to see how so much of this settles, and it may be put off till September.
James, we've got a question here from Gemma Scotcher from DACS. She's congratulating you on making an excellent case for the theatre. What advice do you think you'd give the government on the arts sector, given they're pulled in all directions? What sort of quick, easy wins do you think that they could make? James, you're on mute.
Classic technology faux pas, sorry. I would take advice from you guys, but I mean, I think it's got to be, I imagine with this particular government, we won't necessarily win on the emotional argument, but I think we can make the economic case, which completely stacks up. And then as Amber was saying, I think to use Boris's appetite for being a global facing country, this is the one last remaining currently area where we are global leaders and we're really admired. So I think it's probably that stuff. I mean, Gemma's right, it's not just theatres, it's museums and galleries and a number of the arts world who are suffering. I imagine and I hope galleries will be open before theatres do, because of the social distancing you can do there. In terms of the package, theatre tax credits would help, and it's probably quite an easy win. That legislation already exists and we just need that to be extended. I think extension of furlough schemes for businesses that simply cannot open under government advice, or what are we meant to do? And then unfortunately cash, there's no other way to say it, an emergency relief package to take the shortfall.
Interesting point on the social distancing and the 2 meters. You and I were talking about that the other night, and Andrew Sykes is saying, is it even possible to do a lot of this stuff with the 2 meter social distancing rule? I mean, just explain the problem with that in theatres.
It's yes, there's been lots of sort of quite farcical going around the West End theatres, the tape measure, and looking at what 2 meters would mean. And basically, of course, it's obvious when you say it out loud, but it's not just 2 meters, you're sat there, it's not 2 meters that way and 2 meters that way. It's a three-dimensional circle. And I think the measurement is about, for every one seat you can sit in, you need 16 seats empty around you, which means 20% of the theatre can be full and 80% is going to be empty. And there is no financial model in the world, apart from that not being a huge amount of fun anyway, for the actors on stage and the audience sat there, feeling, Stephanie mentioned confidence, you're just not going to feel confident sat there with those kind of visual optics. So, I mean, 1 meter would probably make all the difference in the world if that was the evolution from Public Health England, but I'm also just aware these old, stuffy, dark buildings, and I think it will take a while for the public to feel willing to go into these buildings and be so close. Panto might, you know, we can laugh at Panto and all its silliness, and it is silly, of course, but actually Panto, as often funds a theatre, a regional theatre, for about 70-80% of its income sometimes. And if we could fight to make Panto's feasible, however we could do that, then that would be help as well. But that just requires Public Health England to change the recommendations. And nobody wants them to do that if it's not safe. We're not trying to risk people's lives, but that would, 1 meter would make all the difference, I think.
And just quickly, I was reading about Claire Foy and Matt Smith's play Lungs. They're planning to sell 1,000 tickets at £65 a pop, so people can watch it virtually.
Yeah.
Is there any future in that?
I think it's absolutely fine as a temporary solution. And one of the huge benefits of this lockdown is the proof of an audience with a huge appetite, and we theatres giving their work away digitally for free to generate new audiences. But we know why theatre is special. Theatre can't compete with Netflix when you're watching it on your screen. You can't, a multi-million pound Marvel movie can't compete with Claire and Matt in a dark space, nor should it. What makes theatre special is that it's live and you're sharing it collectively as an audience together at the same time. So I think that is its virtue, and we can never apologise for that. We just have to wait to give that back again.
I'm going to bring in Wolf Pickley, who's a Teneo analyst, and he's on the phone for technical reasons. But Wolf, I wanted to raise one question which hasn't come up today, which is about the virulence of COVID-19. There's a real sense in which people are beginning to say, look, is it dying out in terms of its impact in the UK? It seems to have fled London, that kind of thing. And yet it's also going rapidly through South America. Huge confusion on this. Have the scientists got this completely right?
I don't know whether they got it right or wrong, but looking at the numbers, the virus infections are rising faster than ever. We now pass the 7 million marks. We have more than 400,000 people dead. And if we look at 2 months ago, when we were going in lockdown, the number of people infected was just 1 million. So we're in a bit of a sort of contradiction here. The cases are increasing, but the push for lifting restriction is equally increasing. What is interesting in terms of the current expansion of the virus that is deeply affecting fragile countries, developing economies, where the health system is struggling, and where also imposing lockdowns is even economically less sustainable than it has been in Europe or the United States, because these are countries where very large informal sectors, where with no ability to put together the shock absorbers that we have seen in Europe, in the UK, and so on. So there is a huge political challenge. When we look at the cases, for me, what is interesting, we have seen a huge spike in Latin America, as you mentioned. When last Sunday alone, it was the 137,000 new cases. This was the peak since the beginning of the crisis. So 137,000 new cases on one day alone. When we look at that, 3/4 of them were basically in 10 countries. Countries where, again, as I said before, the authorities are struggling. When we look also another indicators here about the amount of positive cases once they are tested over time, the huge spike is in places like Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Iran, Indonesia. These five countries together, they have a population of 900 million people. So that is the challenge here. When we look at closer to home, closer to Europe, even in countries where we've been able to, you know, as you said before, deal with the outbreak, put down the numbers, well, recently the news were not particularly great either. In Germany, the R ratio went up to one, was above one on Monday. In Italy, we have seen again a spike in the daily cases of infections. And even in Greece, for example, a country that we discussed many times before has been successful. Suddenly on Monday, they had 52 cases. And the last time they had more than 50 was the 24th of April. Poland, they had to suspend the mines operation because they had an outbreak in various mining plants there. So the picture is even in places where they did well, it's not a particularly comforting one here. One final point from me related to what Stephanie and Amber were suggesting before in terms of confidence and trust, which I totally agree. The reality here is that the UK, at this point, in a survey done by YouGov of 20 countries globally, in terms of confidence of the public in managing the crisis, the UK now is at the very bottom, even done worse than the United States. So at this point, the last data suggests that 41% of the public believes that the government in the UK has handled the crisis well. 56% believe that it mishandled it. This is the worst record. Just to put into perspective, Vietnam is at 95%, Germany is 70%, and so on. So in terms of confidence here, certainly there is plenty the government has to do.
Okay, thank you, Wolf. I've got a question from Yvonne Hilst, which I think is probably for Amber, Stephanie and James. She says, we've had the most divisive leader in the free world come out early saying about the corona crisis that the cure must not be worse than the disease. We will be decades repaying government debts, billions are being forced into poverty, overall health is declining and will continue to do so. The economy and individuals' health are inextricably intertwined. Have we reached the point, or will we, where the cure has proven worse than the disease? I'll start with you, Stephanie. It's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to this, the question that we raised at the start about the potential trade-off. I think economists would still reject the idea that there was a straightforward trade-off between the health crisis and the economic crisis. But, you know, I keep going back to this question of confidence. Because we haven't seen any clarity and because we have no confidence in the test and trace approach here in the UK, the way it's been implemented, then all the rest of this conversation we've had today follows from that. So James talking about people being concerned about going into theatres, you know, all of that is unlocked. All of the question around social distancing is unlocked if people actually don't think that the disease is rife out there and that it, when it is spotted, that it gets controlled. So I talked to our German economist this morning, and he's sitting in Frankfurt. The small towns in Germany, people are swimming again. They're going to the restaurants. They're going to start going to cinemas. He said it's getting very close to normal life. And this is in the space of basically a month of reduced lockdown because people have complete confidence. So I do think, you know, where the disease is worse than the cure, or the cure is worse than the disease, sorry, is when the cure isn't actually a cure, when it's not actually making people feel safe from the disease. And once you solve that, you know, everything else comes after that. But just releasing the lockdown without that in place is not going to actually either, you know, it's not going to cure the disease or the impact that it's had on the economy.
James, have you worried that the cure is worse than the disease sometimes? On mute again.
I should be the young, cool person who's used to technology. I'm terrible. Yes, sometimes. But I mean, I suppose the only mental gymnastics that you can do, I suppose, is to recognise that there had sometimes been some political stagnation, I think, in coming up with big solutions for big problems. And that's just very natural. What this does present, I guess, maybe this is very naive, is an opportunity for huge resets. The debt is not going to go away. The debt is real. And I think the public, I could be wrong, but I think the public has more of a tolerance for it than possibly they did in 2010. I've rejected a lot of the war language that's been used by this particular government in terms of fighting an enemy. But if you're going to embrace the war language, then fine, let's embrace it. Let's get proper 1945 here, except that the debt is going to take 20 years to pay off. Have a department of debt, which we just put over there, and say it's going to be a national effort to pay off over 20 years, and then take the goodest government at their word in terms of actual investment and infrastructure revolution that I think can go to the heart of communities, revolutionise the high street, let people feel, see people, have people see that things are changing physically in their towns and city centres. It's maybe naive, but I think it could be seen as an opportunity to reset some things that needed to be reset a long time.
Amber, we read at the weekend that Boris Johnson had said Christ when he heard that 3.5 million people in the hospitality industry might lose their jobs this summer, which leads you to wonder what on earth he thought was going to happen. But I suppose the question is, he seems to have swung dramatically from obsessing over their health to now obsessing over the economy.
Yes. But I think that Stephanie's point is right, which is that it's about the lockdown. And if the lockdown works, coming out of the lockdown is done well, then I think that people will look back and say it was the right thing to do. If coming out of the lockdown is chaotic and people don't actually come out and don't go back to work, then that portion, I think, will be viewed as having been worse than the cure. But can I just add also, in terms of the original question, I would think that the lockdown was a bad thing. If I was a victim of domestic abuse, or if I were suffering from cancer and 60% of appointments were put off, there are real health consequences to people across the country. So the fact that the health element is still relevant, I think, is live for government as well. The economy is centre stage, but the health consequence of people not being able to access hospitals, being too frightened to go to hospitals, which a lot of them still are, has real health consequences as well.
We heard this morning, Amber, a prediction that by the end of the year, the waiting lists for the NHS are going to be 10 million people. I mean, is that actually sustainable, or can you clear that? I mean, that sounds like
that's an absolute nightmare for the Secretary of State for Health and the Health Department, who will, you know, be longing to be through this and the other side of it, and for people to be talking about the economy rather than the targets that Paul Matt Hancock keeps on being set for him by the Prime Minister. But until that, they've got to start thinking about, they will be thinking now about the devastating consequences for the NHS, irrespective of COVID. The only plus point from the department's point of view is that they will be able to get the financial support that they need for a while now going forward. I mean, any sort of resistance to additional funding for the NHS is over.
Okay. We've got a question, which I think, again, is for the whole panel, is from Andy Payne from the Crown Estate. He's saying, how does the panel think long-term social and economic impacts of COVID-19 will affect government goals to level up and achieve net zero by 2050? So, James, let's start with you. You're from Mansfield, part of the world that feels like it needs levelling up. What are your thoughts around that? Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think people believe it? What do you want to see happening?
Well, they were promised it in the 2019 election. That's one of the reasons a traditionally Labour voting town went Conservative. I'd take advice from Stephanie on this, but I just think people's perception of the nature of money has changed over the past 3 months. It's the figures, and it has been extraordinary, the most the hugest government intervention financially in the economy since the Second World War. I think I could be really wrong, but I think people's understanding of what debt feels like isn't as anxious making or as frightening as it was. Then there's the acceptance that it's going to be there for a long time, and therefore an expectation that those promises made at that election in terms of spending in these particular communities will be honoured. I think, obviously I would say this, but I don't think it's just about transport, infrastructure, roads. I think it's about being really bold and imaginative about what to do with town centres and high streets. And I believe theatres can play a role in that. But I think stimulus in communities that can be perceived physically will help with people's sense that they're being listened to and something is happening.
So just on that point, Stephanie, that, you know, we saw an obsession with sound money and debt for a long time, and then suddenly people see hundreds of billions just being added onto national debt. I mean, again, it sort of like really screws with people's heads, doesn't it? What is it, okay? How worried should we be?
I love the way that James put it, is a sort of, we have a new attitude to money. It is the discovery of the money tree. We did find it. Look, I think that, I mean, going back on the, when you, James also mentioned about the debt, I think there's been a surprising degree of agreement among economists on this, not just about the scale of support needed instantly, which by and large, as I said, has happened, but also that it is a step change in debt rather than something which ought to trigger another many years of austerity. I don't think there is an appetite for that, and there's not a call for that in the way there might have been in 2008, for all the debates we had about rights or wrongs. What we can see already, I'm afraid, is that it does look like, as usual, the southeast is going to come back much more quickly, and the other parts of the country, particularly it looks like in our numbers, the northwest and northeast, are going to have a much less of a V-shaped recovery if we're not careful. So I think that does put the emphasis on making sure that whatever is done is something which has national impact. And I would say on that, it's local government that should be, it's not just the NHS that has been, people have been reminded of the importance of the NHS. It's also, people have seen how local government, local authorities have been able to respond, and they've been more aware of the impact of the cuts we had over the last 10 years. The fact that most of these core local government budgets have been cut by a third. I think that would be at least the imaginative choice, is to follow through on some of the rhetoric around levelling up by giving more, by decentralising more and giving a bit more power to those, at least some of the bigger, the areas that have strong local institutions. You know, George Osborne talked a lot about that. He did some good things, but it was a tiny fraction of the spending that got moved over. If you're Manchester or Mansfield, you know, a tiny proportion of the public spending that happens in your area is actually in your control. So I think that might be an interesting way to do what James is talking about.
But the second half of Andy's question was about net zero by 2050, as well as levelling up. You were Environment Secretary, signed the Paris Agreement, that kind of thing. Are you feeling confident that that's all going to work, given the amount of work we need to do in terms of boosting the economy?
It remains an incredibly ambitious target, but the fact that the UK is hosting COP now next year, and that the Prime Minister is being influenced, shall we say, by a number of people who are making him think about doing things in a more climate-friendly way, I think we will see more stimulus towards greening of the economy. And just to build on Stephanie's point as well, in terms of where it'll happen, it's an easy win for them to do a lot of that spending in the sort of levelling up areas in the north that he promised to do so. So I would expect to see some of those green initiatives. I don't know what they'll be, but you know, it could be housing, it could be normal infrastructure, it could be you know, more wind farms onshore, all those things. I would expect them to try to focus the spending in the areas they've promised to level up.
Okay, thank you so much to the panel. That's been an incredible conversation today. We started with a very powerful contribution from Ursula Burns, a lot from Stephanie on the economy, brilliant stuff from James in terms of what's going on with theatres and how we deal with that, and Amber is ever brilliant on politics. I want you to all to imagine that James's latest play is opening in the West End. It's a brilliant triumph, and that you're giving a standing ovation to the actors who've been in this, Ursula Burns, Stephanie Flanders, James Graham and Amber Rudd. It really was fascinating. Next week we've got another great panel already starting to form. We've got Peter Bazalgette, who's the chair of ITV, Nikki Morgan, who's been asked to be on the government task force for rebuilding the nation after COVID. She's got a small job. She'll also be telling us about that. But in the meantime, thank you very much. Have a good week and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.